Welcome back, subscribers to The Street Pro and The Street Pro Portfolio. Chris Versace here. And as you know, we are entering a very interesting time in the markets. We have the March CPI report coming out tomorrow, as a matter of fact. And we're right on the cusp of the March quarter earnings season. And as I've shared with you in my alerts, I continue to think that forward guidance is going to be critical for the market. In order for it to move sustainably higher from current levels, it's got to support the outlook of at least double-digit earnings growth in the coming year. Now, we'll see. It's a big steep ramp, starting with 2Q and getting higher in the back half of the year. But to talk about that, as well as a number of other things, let's welcome in Cole Smead, the CEO and portfolio manager at Smead Capital Management in Phoenix, Arizona. Can't believe I messed that up. Sorry, Cole. I must still be recovering from the eclipse. Speaking of the eclipse, did you have a high level of blackout?
We had a partial. So I got to see it about probably 40% of the way through the partial. Here is when I peaked. I want to say it was probably about 12 o'clock Phoenix time, so Pacific. And it's a really fun thing. I mean, it just doesn't happen.
One is about 20 years away.
Yep.
But it is pretty interesting that yesterday, I don't know if you saw this, but trading volume, S&P 500, NASDAQ 100, lowest since Thanksgiving. I'm sure some folks think the market is just kind of treading water ahead of the March CPI report. But I suspect a lot of people were checking it out outside. You are right. It was a pretty cool event. Myself was only in about 88%. So in Northern Virginia, and what that means is that it got a little darker, but it didn't go totally pitch black like some other folks that I know in various parts of the country. But anyway. So here we are. Like I said, we're kind of on the cusp of the March CPI report. I think it's going to be important. But, you know, do you think that, Cole? And if you do, I want to hear what your expectations are. But if you don't, you know, what else is kind of top of mind for you when it comes to the market?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we've thought a lot about just the CPI lookbacks and also the futures markets that are trying to set the probabilities of what the Fed is going to do or going to need to do, let's call it, the rest of the year. And I think what's really intriguing to me is the unwillingness of the market to orient its mind around a higher natural rate of interest. Okay. And I'll give a lot actually to Larry Summers on this, and then also Mickey Levy, who's a visiting scholar at Hoover Institute. What I mean by that is there's a lethargy in the market where people want to believe we're going to wake up on, say, like a 3% ish, you know, call it mid 3% short term rate. But I think there's a lot of strong things in the economy right now that make that very tough. Let me just give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
Think of what we think of as American businesses. So we think of like an asset light business, a technology business. Okay. Well, what we've witnessed as the Fed raised rates, which was very aggressive, probably the greatest hiking cycle of the last years, in such a short period of time. And you'll notice that credit sensitive things had trouble. So for example, we've seen real estate slow down rapidly beyond even the demand drop off for, say, things like office. You know, it's going to be tough to see things getting a shovel in the ground anytime soon. The credit problems, not tied to underwriting, but, you know, asset liability, hence why we saw Silicon Valley Bank. So in credit sensitive things, we saw problems. Now, the question might be, well, why did we not see wider problems in the economy? Well, first, housing is long-term liabilities for the household. So therefore, there's not some big credit imbalance for them. But here's what's really important. Because the average American business is more asset light than it's ever been, that means it's not credit sensitive like the past. So you think of the past, 30 years ago, you buy a building, you borrow the money for that, you bleed the interest cost as you amortize that capitalized expense, you know, slowly over time out of your income statement. Okay. Well, today you don't build that building, which
right.
means your investment in your business is not tied to the credit cycle. I'll give you a number to throw at you on this. Fixed business investment. If you look at that that part of the economy, I think the numbers currently are about 35% of it is software. software spending as a percentage of fixed business investment. So what does that mean? That means we've gone from a capitalized expense world to an operating expense world, which means as the Fed raises rates incredibly aggressively, like they had to, I would argue, it's not breaking business, which means that the American economy is going to sustain a higher natural rate because it can bear it, which is just a very, in other words, like if you can't break, is it more natural, is effectively what I'm asking.
Interesting. Interesting. I don't think, you know, it's that's a very differentiated perspective. And I appreciate you sharing that with us. I don't think a lot of folks are kind of digging into it quite that way. But whenever we talk about structural change, you know, there's always going to be some ramifications, and we have to adjust our thinking accordingly. You know, we try to do that from a thematic perspective, where we look at the shifting landscapes of economics, demographics, tech, psychographics, and a few other things. I have to be candid, I haven't really dug that deep into the fixed business investment spending cycle like that. But that's great to hear, informative. But back to the CPI, are you concerned at all that it's going to disappoint the market? The market's looking for it to move down a tick to 3.7% year over year from 3.8% in February. My bigger concern is that if we don't see any movement, the Fed is going to look back and go, holy cow, 6 months, we've been trapped somewhere between 3.8, 3.9, 4%. No real demonstrative movement. To me, it supports the notion that we might only get two, might only get one rate cuts in 2024.
I think we're going to have trouble finding rate cuts, which if you said that to start the year, people would have said, oh, that's crazy to think, because I think we had six baked in to start the year.
Correct.
And now we're in a world where you could make a pretty strong argument there might be zero, plausibly, under certain circumstances. So to your point, CPI is going to stay consistently persistent, in our opinion. That's how we see this world unfolding. Now, you know, what is the Fed really trying to fight in what they're doing? They're actually trying to counteract the fiscal spending. Mm-hmm. That's what the Fed's trying to counteract. In other words, we have too much fiscal spending going on. I think the number on 25 is, if you take Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security increases tied to all the boomers that are retiring, we're going to spend $200 billion. With. So when the Fed is trying to counteract, they're trying to counter off the strength of the economy, which is coming on the back of really strong fiscal spending. Okay. So the question is, can the Fed have as much success as they'd like when any politician that's running today can't run based on austerity? Right. Okay. I think it's a foolish thing to think that the Fed's going to be able to back off on short-term rates like people are hoping. Now, why are stock market participants doing that? They're doing that because they know if the they're low, it's good for assets. The question is that where we're going? And they've been very foolish for about 2 years on that. I think they'll continue to stay foolish. And I mean, just think about this: to collect 5.5% on the short end of the curve right now is a pretty dang good opportunity.
Sure it is.
Okay.
Sure.
But here's where we'll know we'll get into danger zone on fiscal spending. If we go long enough where these people on the short end of the curve are proven foolish because CPI stays more persistent and the Fed has to stay tighter, what the long-term ramification could be is that we could wake up with the market distrusting what the Fed is doing, and we could wake up with a 10-year treasury at 6% when long-term inflation expectations finally move. In other words, back to my, what if the real interest rate is going to be naturally higher in the year ahead? That won't show itself until the market says, you know what, I don't think they have any control of the situation.
Do you think that is why, I mean, you know, the Fed's always a little bit of a cheerleader for the economy, right? So if the Fed ever comes out and, you know, gives a stark warning, all hell is going to break loose, right? Yeah. I think we all know that. So it's understandable that they're a cheerleader for the economy. I think that's why, and I made this point over the last couple of weeks, that is why I think Powell and the Fed are letting the market down gently. And what I mean by that is they keep saying you know, we need to see more good data. We need to see more good data, but we're not seeing that good data. And as long as they stick to that, the market will eventually have to correct its expectations for fewer rate cuts rather than the Fed coming out and saying that, something that would jar the market.
Agree. And by the way, the Fed's had one thing play really to their hand. Just go look at gasoline prices and energy prices. That's benefited. That looks like it's going to start going against them.
I wrote about today. Gas prices, if you look at the bottom in December to where they were as of close to Monday night, this is EIA data, up over 17%.
Correct. So that's going to start to fight into the headline CPI, not the core CPI.
Correct.
But I just say it because, again, it's easy to, when prices are going up, to say we're going to strip it out, and then they back off. You look like you're right. But when they pick back up again, you look like you're stupid to strip it out because they just keep coming back.
Agreed. There's also the ripple effect of higher fuel prices on just about everything else, including higher food prices, which of course the core CPI doesn't pick up. But we as
the Fed calculates OER is it's a misnomer. Most people don't know it's based on a survey.
Okay? And Cole, just for the listening who may not know what OER is.
Owner equivalent rent. So it'd be they go out and survey owners to figure out what their costs are moving towards. And they use those surveys to build what we call OER, owner equivalent rent. Now, I mean, call me crazy, but there's a lot of free data out on the internet, like Zillow, like Redfin. I think there's a better market-based way of approaching that kind of data, but we just don't use it yet, for better or for worse. Right. It's kind of like looking at the futures market to guess what the Fed is doing in the future. We could go out and look at Zillow data. I wouldn't use their forecast. I would just say what's been going on in the last 60 to 90 days. And what you're going to find is housing continues to do at the start of the pandemic. So I just don't think that's fully captured in the inflation data way that is really informing. So everybody looks at their house, it's way up, and you look at the OER data and be like, yeah, it's up, but not as much as my house. So again, I to your point, the things that affect us and touch us aren't fully captured in how they're looking at this. But again, I think their core objective is how do we get rid of the persistence of inflation? And I think they're fighting a ghost. I don't think they can do that because they'd have to have either Trump or Biden or Congress walk in and say, you know what? We've been spending like drunken sailors on leave. We better quit doing this. We look at a lot of this like going from Kennedy to LBJ to Nixon during the 1970s. It's a big expense. That's crazy. And we're going to spend more on our seniors than anything. It's not Ukraine. So throwing out there to criticize Trump, that's like denying all basic math and accounting. That's merely a flesh wound, to quote the Monty Python. And I say that as a card-carrying Republican. Okay. So we're very pragmatic about there is a political problem, and we think therefore that is a market problem because, again, money supply. Okay. Austerity was sexy back then. We did not spend coming off the market bottom. Coming out of the pandemic, spending was powerful. You know, the idea of modern monetary theory, or in Friedman terms, you know, helicopter money, was very powerful in the realm of economics. And we're going to find out how damaging that might be.
Okay. Now, so that kind of sets the stage for take the conversation, the market, right? Strong year to date, at least through the first 3 months of the year, two quarters back to back 10% growth. A lot of people are scratching their head over what is next. As I mentioned earlier, I'm concerned about the earnings season. What are you watching that to help inform where you think the market's going to go next?
Yeah, it's a good question. So to be downright honest, we really pay attention to market earnings. I watch TV. I'll watch Bloomberg, I'll watch CNBC, and you'll hear people talk about it. So I'm not saying we don't have a general sense of what's going on there, but we don't use it. Here's what I do think about from that perspective, though. Let's just say the S&P 500 is a business, okay? It's just one big business. We call it, USA company, okay? Mm-hmm. And I don't think I think about what's my return on my capital. So if earnings are going to grow, but I have to invest a lot more capital, my return on my capital might actually be going down. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think peaks with return on equity. Okay. In other words, when return on equity gets really high, prices for the S&P 500. And then when it falls, which typically, to your point, coincides with earnings going down, people pay less in the future. So I think a lot about the return on equity, because think of, as we think about, like, say, AI, think about the CHIPS Act, all these big investments that are going on currently, they are large capital investments. Okay. And the question is, will we get the return that is commensurate with what we've got in the past from, say, the S&P 500 or that USA Co., like I said, will they match the past returns, or will we drive higher earnings, but the return on equity is actually going down in American business? Okay.
What do you think the answer is?
We've actually, there's a couple out there on return on equity. I'll add two more things to that, because I think in the long term, these are more powerful, but taxes are a big component of return on equity. You think we went from a 35% corporate tax rate to a 21%. Again, I said there's a lot of fiscal problems that we're building up. How do you historically pay those off? Well, higher taxes, and corporate would be a nightmare. Okay. So I say that because that's likely to show up at some point to fix these fiscal problems. But then secondly, the second biggest component in thinking about returns is interest rates, right? The cost of debt. Mm-hmm. So we're at a point right now where companies in mass have not had to refinance yet, right? That's coming. And at the point that American businesses are more refinancings, I think you'll see the interest costs affect that. Again, I know we talk a lot about these big investments in AI and chips. I was just at a TSMC just made another announcement here in Arizona, you know, and there was a lot of pomp and circumstance here with the local government. And we're seeing a lot of that money here locally. But again, that's a big number. How quickly can we drive returns off those big numbers over the next, say, 2-3 years? I think it could be a lot slower than people.
It's going to be slow. Yeah. I agree with you on that. And my thinking is that when it comes to the CHIPS Act AI, I think that it's, we're talking, you know, 2-3 years to really start seeing it, especially with the CHIPS Act.
Correct.
Right.
And to give it another analogous view, to your point, we did something similar in the late 90s. Okay. We went out to a bunch of power companies and said, hey, listen, what, you already have power. What if you can do data? So a bunch of the utilities tried to get in the data business. And those were big investments, to your point. Okay. Now, in the long run, they ended up making money in those businesses. What happened in the short run? A lot of people went bankrupt trying to be in the data business.
Yes.
Okay.
Because
it was such a large investment.
For the listener out there, you also saw like railroad companies trying to get in the data business, where they were going to lay cable along the rail tracks and monetize and all this other stuff. And it was to say it was at a time when everybody wanted to be in that business, similar to what you're seeing today with AI. It's analogous, right? Whenever we see one of these big structural changes that have potentially earth-shaking implications, and everybody's tossing their hat in, there are companies that should be in it. There are companies that need to be in it, just given the nature of how they support other companies. But there's others who toss their hat in the ring that want to be players, even though they have no business being in that business.
Well, correct. And then, by the way, to your point, that competition is going to grow. So I'll give you one more way of like looking at let me go to the heart of AI real quick and just say, okay, there's some of these historical issues that could be present, but I'll add one more thing. If you go out and look, I think I was looking, this is for this year, the street's expecting NVIDIA to make 60% net income margins. Okay. So what comes to my mind when I hear that is I think it's the 1998 Berkshire meeting where Buffett's talking about this idea of high return at the time, higher than him and Charlie had thought. Okay. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, let's just say there's 500 Jack Welch's out there. Okay. In the long run, you know, things are going to mean revert because there's really smart people out there. And so therefore, if you're producing above the return on equity of the market, but there's 499 other people just like you, you're probably going to end up going to the market's return on equity. I say that because in NVIDIA's case, 60% net income margins are crazy high. what I would argue is ultimately in long-term capitalism, unsustainable net income margins. So if you look at the growth of technologies, as unit volumes go up, margins go down.
Past a certain point.
Correct, because prices of the units go down. Okay. And so I say that because I think a lot about as we grow the use of AI, which we unequivocally are, like we're going to grow the use of AI like we grew the use of the internet, as an example. The question is, like, look today at the data companies. How easy is it to be Comcast, where you're in the data business, but you're losing your old broadband, or your cable business? Again, that's a tough transition, and there will end up being a slow growth period. But if you and I sit down today and say, hey, you know, my neighbor came to my house and he said that he found this business that he can make 60% net income margins in, you and I would say, let's go into business
and
go compete with
them. That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
And that's what's going on right now. People are looking and saying, if they're going to make those net income margins, to quote the great theologian Jeff Bezos, your margin is my opportunity.
Sure.
And I think that's what we're going to see. So I think we're going to see a margin decrease while unit volumes go and prices decline on the good.
So I don't disagree. I mean, you're really talking about the law at some point of diminishing marginal returns.
Correct.
But I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we're going to be there for a little while because we're still in the infancy of that market. So I think what you're talking about is probably subject to new innovations, new disruptions, probably 3-4 years away.
Well, except that if you go out to the market and say, okay, where are you going to get earnings growth? Let's say you're going to, that's getting fewer and far between. In other words, like energy companies aren't having a big pickup, and they're having a pickup, but they're small. You have to get big growth in earnings via tech to grow S&P earnings.
Wow,
too big.
Of course you do, because if you look at the top 10 holdings, right?
Correct.
You're looking at those Sainted Seven, Magnificent Seven, the whatever you want to call them. So of course those have to be demonstrative earnings growers, right? In order to power the S&P 500 higher. I agree with you.
Well, correct. And they got to hold a stable valuation too. But, you know, it's like you have to not only grow earnings, but, and I just say that because from an analogous perspective, this looks like the Nifty 50 to us. Just to your point, it's a much smaller basket of companies ultimately. And by the way, what did the Nifty 50 do? They grew their earnings wonderfully. They had great balance sheets. I mean, if you go look at Coca-Cola from 72 to 79, it did fantastic. I think it produced 25 to 30% return on equity with no debt. And what happened? The stock went down 55% over 7 years. Okay. So again, that's why we don't think a lot about earnings growth, because to your point, I think that's baked in.
Yes. Which is why, you know, as I mentioned earlier, that the consensus EPS figure for 2024 is 10.5% EPS growth. For the market to go higher from where we are, given where the PE multiples were coming into the month of April, that earnings growth has to surprise to the upside.
Yeah.
Now, I will say this, that is for the market, right? But you're an investor, we're an investor, we don't buy the market, we look for other opportunities that have, you know, more favorable characteristics, whether it's a return on capital, earnings growth, what have you.
Sure.
And with that, let's pivot a little bit, Cole, because right before we started rolling, you had mentioned what your largest holding was, which might surprise some folks. It's an Italian bank, UniCredit, I believe. Why such a large holding for you? And are you more enamored right now with non-US equities than US equities?
Well, I think, you know, to our discussion just a second ago, I think the mania in this era of stock investing is obviously a US game. That's where the mania has been. Just as a case in point, where did banks disappear? They didn't disappear in Europe recently. They disappeared in the United States. So it shows you how much stupider Americans were based on the cost of money, misallocation of capital, in our opinion. Now, here's what's interesting. So that, like you point out, our largest holding in our international fund is UniCredit. Okay. Now, someone says, well, how did you end up with like 10% of your portfolio in one single stock? Well, it's really simple. You buy a business that nobody else wants, and they're buying back a lot of their stock. And what happened was the business's returns improved, AKA earnings grew, but earnings grew relative to the capital they had. In other words, their return on equity went up. Mm-hmm. So we went out and bought a business that originally, you know, call it a couple of years ago, was probably going to produce something like 8% return equity. Would we sit down in a normal conversation and say, gosh, that's such great return equity? We'd say, no, that's terrible. That's a very low return on equity. But the difference was they had plans to go out and buy 20%+ of their stock. They were very public on that. To give you a little accounting fix, if anybody, any of your listeners love this stuff, if you go out and buy a bunch of stock back at 4/10 of book, when you produce 8% return equity, what you'll notice is return on equity is just the growth of your book via your income statement, right? Using net income. But when you buy back stock at really depressed valuations like that on a book basis, if you go track book value per share, it will cause it to grow faster than mm-hmm. your return on equity. So it was like buying a business that's going to go out and produce 100% book value growth, even though the return on the business was low. What ended up happening? It's bizarre. It ended up producing, they're producing like 12-13% return on equity right now. So we got into this world where things ended up being way better for the operating business itself, and everything they did on the balance sheet produced a lot of wealth for the shareholders by growing book and getting rid of shareholders that shouldn't be there. Okay, so I say that because here's the weird part. I've never seen a stock triple where people aren't talking about it at the end of that. Okay, I just don't see that. Dogs chase cars, people chase stocks. It's the way God made this world. And watching a stock triple anywhere in the world, I don't care where it is, that's a multi-billion dollar market cap like that, and nobody even knows, that's bizarre.
It's fascinating given the parabolic moves that we're seeing in gold, oil, cocoa, and commodities that are catching headlines. But you would think something like that would stand out.
Not at all. But again, I think it's because the eyes are all on U.S. markets. And to your point, the eyes are really on, you know, 7 to 10 big companies. That's it. And because to our discussion earlier, that's what moves the S&P 500. Okay. You know, we're past the point of the S&P being, it's bigger than half the market. It's the passive nature of this market is just so large that, again, why are those things focused on? Because that's where the money's at. It's a pretty simple, that's why Willie said, example, right?
Right, right.
So I just say that because I find that really intriguing. Because again, just in this world, we're sitting down and saying, hey, where can we buy attractive return streams? And we pay prices that are did last fall in the regional banks of the United States. So I'm not here to tell people that, gosh, this sucks to be in the US stock market. No, it sucks to be in the S&P 500, but I don't got to own that. God didn't require me to do that when I was born. Now, there are some institutions that believe they're required by God to do that. And we don't doubt if that's a successful strategy or not.
Agreed. Yeah, we don't. I always say that we do not buy the market. We have to be mindful of the market things, but we do not, as investors, buy the market. We seek out companies with, more favorable or superior metrics, or at least prospects for improving.
Sure. Well, let me ask you a weird question, Chris, because I'll answer this too. But I think it's just a fun thing to think about. If I ask you the question, what keeps you up at night? Like, if you're going to wake up in a cold sweat, what's that? Is there one thing that kind of haunts you? And I have something top of mind, but I if you want, I could share mine first, and then you could share yours. But I that's a question we sometimes get. There is something that haunts my mind, but I'd love to kind of throw it out to you.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I mean, no shortage of things for a person who doesn't sleep very well. But I will say that probably one of the things that really kind of that spooks me a little bit, and it's rather time. And then candidly, not to get political, but, you know, I see two extremely old white guys running for president. And I just think to myself, boy, oh, boy, I wouldn't give my dad the TV remote. What are we doing here?
That's a totally rational concern. So here's, I mentioned this looks like the Nifty 50 to us. Okay.
Yep.
What scares me the most is going to be like 1972 to 74. So in other words, like as we think about where we're going in this unknown world, that's a possible path, right? In other words, I can't sit down and say it's 100% chance it's going to happen, but there's a likelihood we have to think about where in 1972 to 74, it didn't matter what you owned. Everything got crushed. Now the Nifty 50 got crushed the most, but enthusiasm for stocks and disappeared. They went from being something that people loved to talk about in 1969 to the bottom in 74, where, by the way, to your point on politics, we had a president resigning in disgrace. We just had an oil shock in 73. So there were bad problems that came with that. But I just say it because the idea that the cult of stock owners will always be there, regardless of the circumstances, I don't believe that because numerous times over long periods of time, they disappear. And so I always joke with people right now. I say, listen, at the top of markets, you always find long-term investors. The question is, find them at the bottom of markets.
That's when the money's to be made, though. I think your point touches on what we saw emerge over the last several quarters when the TINA, there is no alternative, kind of fell by the wayside as interest rates moved higher. I mean, do nothing and earn 4.5% through my Apple card. And that was the easy thing to do. You know, it's since fallen, 4.4%, something like that, but still. So where you talked a second ago about looking for attractive return streams. I know you like energy. I know you like financials. Let's talk about why.
Yeah. So these are capital intensive businesses. And I think that is part of the reason why you can get these prices with these return streams. In other words, I put out the idea earlier, and it just so happens to really help the oil business, historically speaking, because it's a proxy of geopolitical risk.
Okay. Totally.
So as we're watching Iran kind of kick up dust this last week, what's been going on? You know, there's been a rising premium for spot oil prices. I mean, this is not brain surgery. So we like that we can go out and buy energy companies. We're buying anywhere from a 15 to 25% return on equity, and we can be paying 2x book or less for those businesses. What are they also doing? They're returning all that capital to us, you know, hopefully mostly through buybacks, but some of that via dividend as well. And so I think that's the same math. In the case of the banks, it's going to take us, say, 3 to 5 years to clean up banking. When I say clean up banking, think of the real estate assets that sit out on books that we know they're not worth what they're showing. This will be like a mini resolution trust corp like we had during the savings and loan crisis, where it will take 3 to 5 years to clean up certain banks' portfolios, not all banks, but certain banks. So we're kind of playing for a future where we have 30% less banks, and the banks that are running good books, producing good returns, will swallow them up at discounts and drive higher returns. In other words, we're going to continue to accrue and swell through consolidation. So I say that because I'll give you a bank example. Western Alliance Bank is one of the regionals we bought. Western Alliance runs very high return on equity historically, 15 to 18%, which is very high for a bank. Okay. Now, why? Well, they're not a retail bank. They're a commercial bank, and they're in certain business lines that allow them to create good spreads. I'll give you an example. Deposits was the name of the game last spring. Did you have good deposits? Well, they're the largest, this is crazy to say, they're the largest homeowners association and timeshare deposit bank in the country. Hmm. Now, why do I find that so attractive? How many people want to be on a homeowners association board? The answer is like no one in their right mind, but if they're in a community that has one, they have to have a board. Well, does that group sit around every day and say, gee, I wonder what I can get in higher interest rates at Merrill or Schwab or my bank?
Not at all.
They sit around saying, how does my job get as easy as the chairman of the HOA as possible? And so what do? They tend to not be interest seeking, which means if you're their bank, you love them, because it's very sure captive deposits.
Sure.
And so I think of Western Alliance like a spread collector. Okay. So I joked with someone the other day that we're kind of in the mob business. When I say mob, the banks are good spread businesses if you're good at doing spreads. Much like I was just at the NCAA finals last night, which was supposed to be here in Phoenix. If you're in the betting business, you just got to make sure to set your book up with a good spread. That way you don't care who wins or loses. Right. You cover your bets by the spread, okay? Like the mob used to run, okay? And that's the kind of era we're in, where there are really good spread businesses. Yes, they're tied to the economy, but not everyone is good at bookmaking and not everyone is good at banking. And that's what we're seeing play out in banks currently. And so another name that we own that's a very good way of looking at that, we own a company called Credit Acceptance Corporation, which is actually a subprime auto lender. Again, it's playing at that idea of like we're providing credit to people that can't get credit anywhere else because they're subprime. They have really poor credit scores. Okay. And so there are very attractive returns in those arenas. And here's the good part, because everyone got so scared of banking, they decided to pay way less for banks.
So,
which is why we got interested.
So you mentioned these others, but I believe that you're also somewhat favorable to some of the large banks, JP Morgan,
yeah.
Bank of America. Is it because your comment of seeing, I think you said 30% fewer banks in the next several years, do you see those mega banks just picking up incremental share?
Yeah, I mean, they have. So I think if someone says, like, look at those banks, I mean, just go look at the bank runs last spring. Okay. You know, they continue to gain deposit market share. Okay. Now, did that translate into better returns in the interim? No, because obviously deposit beta picks up, they're paying more on their deposits. And that's a cost if you can't go lend that money out right away. So they're not getting a return to match on the lending side. So what's happened in the interim is the big banks have gained market share, but because there's not new lending in the economy to you know, off those deposits, it's a near-term headwind from a cost perspective. So I think the bigger benefit will be the non-majors. Okay, now we've owned, just to give you a sense, we've owned Bank of America since early 2012, and then we bought JP Morgan off the whale trade. So those have been long-term investments for us. We've really liked the return streams we got out of those. We've got great returns from those historically, but why were we stepping into the regional lenders? Because you could get way better prices with similar or higher return streams.
So I understand that argument. If we see the IPO market come back,
yeah,
and there seems to be signs that we could be seeing that, you'll see a greater benefit at JP and Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, than you sure. will these smaller regional banks.
Sure. I'll go one step further on my biggest fear conversation, and if we want to talk about this, we could go into it, but it's our opinion. I know it's not going to sound crazy, and I don't mean to have anybody run into their money market fund anytime soon, but we personally think the S&P 500 will not make money over the next decade. Okay. Including dividends reinvested. And I'm not talking about real returns. I'm saying nominal, but I think that therein lies that in real terms, there will be negative real returns to the S&P. So, again, go back to my 1970s conversation, okay? How mm-hmm. good was the IPO window once 74 was over? People didn't want to touch stocks. They'd gone from over-owning them in 69. If we look, there's Fred data. You had your Freudian slip on the Fred data. If you look at equities as a percentage of household financial assets in the Fred data, there's three highs, 69, 99, and 2021 were roughly near the 2021 highs. I point that data out because if you plot the forward 10-year S&P 500 returns from those data points, this is a terrible time to be a buyer of the S&P 500 because in the last instance, 99, which was lower than today, you made negative money. Okay, so when I say zero, I might be conservative in zero, possibly. Okay, but here's why I say that: poor equity returns are tough for banking markets, the ones you're talking about. And so I was sitting with some VC folks the last couple of days, just having conversations, and the idea that, you know, this will affect the stock market, obviously, but this will affect other markets. How are VCs going to get exit liquidity?
No, they can't. They won't.
And so I think a lot of this is piggybacked on the, you know, similar ideas. Here's what I think is good out there. At least the bond market's been more honest, right? The bond market had to deal with some real problems. It's been more honest. Look at the real estate market. It's like a swear word at times in certain parts of the real estate market. So I think those markets have actually begun to really price in future problems. I don't think stocks, to our discussion about what are earnings growth going to be and things of that nature, I don't think the future problems are anywhere near priced in. And to our discussion, they're kind of unknowable. I kind of don't care because I don't own them either.
Right, right. Well, I could tell you this, that, you know, we've sat back a little bit and watch the continued melt up that we've seen, particularly in the most recent quarter. We've been opportunistically buying certain stocks on pullbacks, you know, but we have not been, you know, spending like drunken sailors. We've actually got about 17% of the portfolio in cash. We've got some inverse ETFs in there as well, but we do have some energy names. We have some tech names and a variety of others. So I actually like our positioning. I'm a little more, I guess, optimistic maybe than you are, Cole, about the next 10 years. But as folks who listen to this podcast, folks who read the alerts that we put out, they know that we're constantly digesting the data, reframing the argument.
Yeah.
Because the biggest danger to me is when you don't let the data, as I like to say, talk to you.
Yeah.
It's when you want to superimpose your opinion on the data.
Yeah.
That's where you can go off. So I suspect that you're the same way. So that while you might be charting history, you're going to, you know, let the data talk to you and you'll revise your outlook over time.
Correct. I mean, to your point on that data set, like that data set, we update it every quarter when the FRED data comes out, just mm-hmm. to ask, where are we at? And I only point it out because if you compare those two data sets, the correlation coefficient is negative 0.85. So someone says, Cole, what does that make you think? I say, well, it's not a perfect relationship. It's not a perfect right. inverse relationship. It's a pretty strong relationship on an inverse basis, though. And so to your point, that doesn't tell you when or
right.
why. Okay. Like, but here's what I love about the data set. It's agnostic to the sign of the times, right? Does it say, oh, by the way, in 1969, it was go-go stocks. And we're going to have the Nifty 50 within 3 years.
No,
it doesn't say that at all. So the times change, but that data set has proven to be pretty powerful over time. And that's why I like it. Cause again, we're back to kind of like, well, what are the odds?
Yes.
We're just going to set out odds. And I you're totally right on that. When I show people that data, what I'm often blown away by is they'll kind of look and say, well, that data might not be relevant. Well, it's been relevant for about 71 years so far.
Yeah, it's a mistake to dismiss data just because you don't like what it has to say.
Correct. And by the way, to your point, I'm a stock person. I was born owning stocks. I'll die owning stocks. To your point, we own 5% cash in our U.S. fund. We have 1% cash in our international fund. So we are stock people. So I'm not here to say, hey, gosh, it's going to suck to own stocks. What I'm saying is it's going to suck to own the S&P 500.
Totally agree. And, you know, when nobody likes it, when it's priced right, if you could see an improving return on capital, return on equity, or a company benefiting from some structural change that's about to happen, that's a great time. That is
Agreed.
A great time. Now, before we get out of here, Cole, there is something behind you that I have to ask you about because
yeah.
we are on a podcast, but you have a podcast. Tell me real quickly about your A Book with Legs podcast.
Well, yeah, and I know this is an audio podcast, but as I look at you, I can see your books in the background. So I think this is very fitting. But so it's called A Book with Legs. It's out on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, et cetera. It's a liberal arts podcast. So to your point, in investing in the data we consume, we're lifelong learners. This is the last liberal art, I would argue, and investing is a lifetime of learning. And so what we do twice a month is we interview authors. This is not like your cute, pithy, typical interviews where it's like, oh, tell me about your book. 3 minutes later, well, thanks for having you on. Have a good day. This is like long form, 60 to 80 minutes. We're deep in the book. And so it's just a very fun format where, to your point, you get to get into the ideas. You get to ask further questions. Our most recent was Milton Friedman, written by Jennifer Burns from Hoover Institute. And by the way, to your listeners, if they got book recommendations, we're all ears. Please, you know, find us on Twitter, find us on our website. We love book recommendations because we often get great ideas in our investing from, you know, analogous ideas we've got out of our books.
Just a couple of things. One, I'll check it out because I do like long form conversations. That's why I do this.
Yeah.
I agree with you. The People magazine, give me 3 questions. You learn nothing.
Exactly.
So I prefer not to do that. I will send you some book recommendations because while you see these books behind me, you don't see the 2 other stacks of books that
yeah.
are also here. And I assume you, is there any type of book that's off limits?
So it's funny. People ask me, you know, what kind of books do I read? I rarely read fiction books. You know, not because I don't want to have a wandering mind. I just rarely read fiction. But here's the one thing I will say. When I read fiction, I go to Hemingway.
Okay.
I visited his house in Key West. And so I'm kind of naturally I go to Hemingway when I want to get into fiction.
So I'm looking over here, just putting my laptop down, scanning. And I've got Behave. I've got Nudge. I've
mm-hmm.
got The Experience Economy, Order Out of Chaos, and about 6 other books that I can't read because they're slanted sideways. So,
well, I'm sure you have like Stocks of the Long Run by Jeremy Siegel somewhere in your stack.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's over here behind me.
Yeah,
Finding
I was gonna say,
the next, you know, like here, finding the next Starbucks by the gentleman who founded, what was it, GVH Capital. And of course, the book that started it all for me, One Up on Wall Street with Peter Lynch.
Yeah, great book. So. Yeah, totally great book. I agree.
All right. Excellent. Excellent. Well, Cole, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your deep dive into things and your insight and your thoughts. What I appreciate most about it is that they're not necessarily aligning or overlining or overlapping with all of my thoughts, but I think that makes for a great conversation. And I'm hoping you'll come back in the future.
Yeah. Appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. All right, folks. That is our podcast for this week. My thanks to Cole Smead, CEO and PM at Smead Capital Management, for joining us. We'll be back with another conversation next week.